You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and there's at least some reason for hopefulness in the air these days. The Redskins are back to 2-2. The Orioles and Nationals are in the playoffs. It's a happy Jewish New Year. It's a happy fiscal New Year with no government shutdown. And on top of that, we hope there's at least some reason for hopefulness in Afghanistan. But that'll be for you to decide as you listen to us. Our goal here today is to talk about Afghanistan and the kinds of issues that should be on the next president's agenda as he or she thinks through a proper strategy going forward in light of all the hopeful signs, but also, of course, the many troubles that that land faces. I'm honored today to be the moderator for an extraordinarily distinguished panel. I'm sure many of the faces on this panel you already know. They are all extraordinarily accomplished Americans in general in their careers and specifically in regard to Afghanistan. I'm not going to go through detailed introductions, but let me just highlight a brief point about each. And then we will, of course, have a bit of an opening round of discussion up here. I'm going to pose a sort of a broad question to each person in line, and then we'll have some conversation amongst ourselves and then go to you about 45 or 50 minutes into this. I should say this conversation begins from the foundation of a paper that the five of us and another 12 or 13 former officials and scholars regarding Afghanistan who have worked on or in Afghanistan over the years put forth. The National Interest published it. You can also find it on the Brookings website. Other websites like the Atlantic Council, I believe, have also put it forth. Came out in September with some broader and deeper and more detailed views on the subject. And we're not going to try to cover the entirety of the paper. Moreover, we're going to allow each person, of course, to speak for himself rather than just hewing to talking points. But I want you to know the paper is out there. To my immediate left is General David Petraeus, retired U.S. Army, one of the most accomplished American military commanders, not only today, but I think in American history. Of course, was the famous architect and chief commander of the Iraq surge. Also, then after a stint at Central Command, kindly and incredibly generously was willing to accept the president's request to go try to work his magic again in Afghanistan and commanded the International Security Assistance Force there from 2010 through 2011. To his left is Ambassador Ron Newman, who, along with his father, is one of the only father-son, one of the only two father-son teams in American history to be ambassador to the same country. And those of you who remember your history will remember it's John Adams and John Quincy Adams who were ambassador to France, and it's Ronald Newman and his father who were both ambassador to Afghanistan. So in addition to his remarkable military career that included combat tours in Vietnam and ambassadorships in the broader Middle East and a career in the Foreign Service, he was ambassador for George W. Bush in Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007, has stayed very active on the subject ever since. To his left is Ambassador Jim Cunningham, who was ambassador for one of the longest stints in modern American history, not quite what Ron Newman's dad pulled off in the late 60s and early 70s when I think he was ambassador for six straight years. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that being deputy ambassador and then full ambassador for more than 3 years in recent times probably counts even more than those chronological years would suggest. Remarkable dedication to the subject has been associated ever since with the Atlantic Council writing on Afghanistan and continuing his focus on that country and its implications for American security. And then speaking of great American heroes who have had amazing careers, Ambassador James Dobbins, who in many ways has been the sort of troubleshooter number one for American presidents ever since 9/11, with missions as a special envoy for either peace process or reconstruction all over the world, but certainly in the Balkans, certainly in parts of the broader Middle East and Africa, and in Afghanistan. So Jim Dobbins was the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in recent years, I think 2013 through 14. He's also done a lot of great work over the years at the RAND Corporation, where he remains today. So without further ado, let me begin with General Petraeus. And I really just want to ask the big, simple question of what's the big idea in this paper, General, and what do you see as the big idea for American foreign policy in Afghanistan going forward?
Well, first of all, thanks, Dr. Mike, for being the coach of this team and the first drafter and all the rest of this. I will note that you left off in discussion the reasons for optimism, a hugely important one, and that is, of course, that the Army football team has started the season 3-1 this year. This is an extraordinary reversal of experience in recent years. Some of you will recall that I've always had one topic that was off limits for questions, that being why Army football can't beat Navy. And we may relax that this year, hopefully. And what a pleasure it is to be with three of America's truly greatest diplomats, several of whom, each of whom really I've been privileged to work with over the years in a variety of different capacities. Well, the big ideas here, I think, are several. The first is that we continue to have very important national interests in Afghanistan. I would hold out the two that I think are the most important. The first is the reason that we went to Afghanistan and the reason that we have stayed, and that is to ensure that Afghanistan is never again a sanctuary for al-Qaeda or other transnational extremists the way it was when the 9/11 attacks were planned there and the initial training of the attackers was conducted there. And we have indeed accomplished that mission to date. So that really is the core. When I was privileged to be the commander of the International Security Assistance Force and U.S. forces there, the commander of U.S. Central Command, that was what the most important task was in mind. We very much wanted to help Afghanistan in a host of other ways, but I'd also note that we had very realistic assessments of what we thought we could achieve. There was never any kind of dream of turning Afghanistan into Switzerland in 10 years or less. There were quite significant obstacles to that, to put it mildly, but that core objective was and is the reason that we are there. Beyond that, we have also, of course, found Afghanistan to be a hugely important platform for our regional counterterrorism operations. It's publicly known that the raid to get Osama bin Laden was launched from there. It's publicly known that various other activities are conducted from there, and that platform remains very important to us. I'd note, as the paper does, as an aside, we're welcome in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The Afghans and their government want us to be there. We have indeed improved life for Afghans in a host of different ways, whether it's infrastructure, education, various elements of the economy and so forth. The progress has been quite substantial. And, of course, Afghan security forces, to whom we began transitioning tasks toward the end of my time as COM-ISAF in the spring of 2011, very much fighting for their country and sadly dying for their country in quite considerable numbers, perhaps unsustainable numbers. And that does indeed give us, it's one of the many reasons for concern there. The fact is that the situation has deteriorated in recent years. We did halt the momentum of the Taliban and roll it back during the surge, if you will, when, again, I was privileged to be the commander. We did indeed accelerate the development of the Afghan security forces and begin handing off tasks to them that was ultimately completed. We did help support, and again, now we're in the diplomatic and development arenas, the development of Afghan institutions so that we could hand tasks to them as well. But all of these have come under increasing pressure by the Taliban and the other associated groups that do not want to see Afghanistan succeed on the trajectory that it's been now since liberation from the Taliban in late 2001. The Haqqani network, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, al-Qaeda, small elements, small Islamic state, et cetera, all active and all trying to regain control of areas that they might have controlled, say, before the surge, and to cause problems for the Afghan government and the Afghan people. Right now, for example, literally in the last 24 hours, we've seen reports of renewed fighting in Kunduz. I have been assured by some individuals on the ground at quite high level that there are U.S. Special Forces on the ground with supporting Afghan commandos and that they believe that they have that in control. The district of Nawa, one of those that we clawed back during the surge in Helmand Province, has been the police chief there, has been killed in the past day or so, a tragic loss. and the police station for a period was overrun by them as well. And then Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand, under increasing threat also, although, again, I'm told that there are some 1,700 Afghan forces in there and advisors, and there are enormous efforts to enable those forces with the assets that we have. Nonetheless, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs himself has described this as a stalemate during a recent visit. You can look at that in a number of different ways. One, you could say, well, stalemate's not all bad if the Afghans control 70 or 75 or somewhere between 65 and 75% of the country. On the other hand, we can sometimes hearken back to the language, I think it was General Pace as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who said, in this kind of struggle, if you're not winning, you're losing. Regardless, the situation is, as we describe it, fraught. It is concerning. And therefore, the bottom line is that we believe that the next administration should make an enduring commitment to Afghanistan and our partners there. That's the real bottom line, and if you will, the headline, that we should not have to go through the annual reviews to see where you are and how you're going to draw down or what have you, that we should use the assets that we have there as effectively as we possibly can to support our Afghan security force counterparts. As many of you will know, those were restricted. Our air power was restricted for quite some time. Some of that has been relaxed. We think it warrants even further examination to determine how we can indeed help individuals with whom for whom we provided close air support when we were fighting shoulder to shoulder with them, but then did not do that for some period of time until more recently. So those are the kinds of initiatives that should be pursued. I will allow my diplomatic counterparts here to discuss some of the other elements of this, because this is an enduring commitment that is not a blank check. It has to be a commitment from both sides of this endeavor, and there are indeed causes for concern in the governance arena and the habitual concern of corruption in governance and so forth. But indeed, again, the key is an enduring commitment to a country that has, in which we have these two very important national interests, and where we very much want to see those interests continue to be safeguarded and preserved.
Thank you. And before I go to Ron, let me just ask one small clarifying question, General Dave, because you mentioned the 65% to 75%. We all know these figures are rough.
Yeah.
But could you just clarify what you're referring to? Are you referring to land area or to population?
Yeah, I think this is the land area generally, I think, is how it's. But I would not probably should go back to the individual who quoted me that term. I mean, this is just an indicator that three-quarters of the country or a little less than that is generally assessed to be under the control. We had this very sort of somewhat complex district categorization that we used to go to, and I think it's an outgrowth of that. But I wouldn't want to be, I guess, quoted on that then,
right,
as which it is.
So let me, by the way, mention as I go to Ron for the next question that the other generals, former commanders who were part of this paper, this Forging an Enduring Partnership paper that we did, included General John Campbell, General John Allen, General Stanley McChrystal, and General Dave Barno. And I'll sort of give you in digestible numbers some of the other authors as we go forward. Ron, given your focus on Afghanistan for many years, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Afghan politics. And that's a bit of an open-ended question, but I don't know to what extent you want to put the sort of current situation with Dr. Ghani and Dr. Abdullah in historical perspective, to what extent you want to talk about how they're doing, if there's anything hopeful about their sort of strange, somewhat forced, but somewhat unruly partnership, or if you want to talk about next steps for the United States in dealing with them. So I'll just put the big, broad question of Afghan politics on the agenda for you, please.
Thank you. That should be enough for one answer. Afghanistan is incredibly complex. The result of a long war and complexity is that a great many people's analysis and opinions are fixed, so that they now want or automatically assess each new fact to fit in the mental paradigm they've already constructed. And Afghanistan is sufficiently complex that if your opinions are completely opposite, you can find the facts to support either side. the fact that the media then doesn't cover Afghanistan very much makes it even more difficult for people to come to independent judgments. Then there's a lot going wrong. I'm frequently reminded of the former Interior Minister Ali Jalali, who was asked to explain Afghanistan in one or two words and said one word, good, two words, not good. because there's a lot of that. The week, however, opened, or the weekend came with a surprisingly hopeful note for me, which was a long story by Carlotta Gall in the New York Times. And you need to understand that her father, Sandy Gall, was in Afghanistan. She has covered Afghanistan for years. She is one of the most experienced journalists on Afghanistan. And the article begins with very downbeat, with a lot of problems. But it ends on a very upbeat note, looking at the younger generation, at things that have changed since 2001. And it's rare that you get an article by an experienced observer that is upbeat, so I was very happy with that. General Petraeus made, I think, the first absolutely key foundational point about our views in the paper, which is that we have big interests that merit remaining in Afghanistan. The question which obviously follows after that, and which is both political and military, is it possible to achieve those interests? And that's where the mixture of events in Afghanistan comes in. Politics are messy. Ghani government, Dr. Abdullah, is fighting with each other. The bottom line for me is, yes, it is possible. That is not the same as guaranteed. That is not the same as there is some smooth line continuity that you could say, we're here now, we'll be there tomorrow, we were here yesterday at this point. This is going to be much more like a roller coaster ride. But why do I say it is still possible? Well, for several reasons. First of all, we have a willing ally. General Petraeus already talked about the Army, so I won't spend time on that. If we are not losing and if things are not as good as we would like, and they're not, it's also not Iraq. This is not an army that's thrown down its weapons and run from the battlefield. That's a big difference. Secondly, on the American side, a lot of the problems are partially self-induced. We tried very hard to move faster than we, I think, possibly could, forced by political pressures, to turn things over faster than we can, you know. We don't expect to produce an infantry battalion commander, they used to tell me, in less than 20 years, but we expected to do it, and we were determined that we would be required to do it in much less. Afghan politics have always been messy. They were messy when I first went to the country in 1967. They're particularly messy now because people have known only war for 30 years. And when people have known only war, they don't expect things to get better. One young Afghan woman who now directs a major school in Kabul, dynamic U.S. educated, but she told me when she first came to the U.S., she was met by her host family, and they said, oh, your timing's so good, we've got this 3-day weekend coming up in a couple of months, we're going to go to some amusement park. And she said her first reaction was, how can they possibly be planning something 2 months from now? The life she had known was so insecure and so constantly changed by external factors over which she had no control that she just didn't understand this idea. And she said she spent the next 2 months waiting every day for something to happen that would ruin the plan. Well, there's a huge difference between the sort of basic optimistic view of Americans and how you look at plans. And if your plan is moving along, you think that means it'll work and you're optimistic. If you're an Afghan, the plan's moving along, that doesn't mean anything. You look at today. And so people have built habits of fighting for political control. They're fighting politically, they're not fighting with guns. So there are a lot of people scrapping for power. And that makes the politics really messy. And I think the chances are that the rest of the Ghani Abdullah term will stay messy. That we will keep it together. They will probably keep it together. Government will move forward, but it will be messy. And this is one of the reasons that we talk in the paper about the need for an enduring commitment, because we're going to have to ride through a lot of these things.
Fantastic.
That said, you know, it is possible. There has just been an election bill signed. Now we have to keep feet to the fire and see that it gets implemented. But the tendency to say, all this is hopeless, I think that's exaggerated. It's exaggerated also because Americans are impatient people. And, you know, impatience has done a lot to create great things and progress. But you have to differentiate between the impatience that leads to progress and the impatience of a small child that leaves everything scattered on the floor and walks away because they're frustrated. And if you accept the interests, then we should not be frustrated. Then we just have to have a look, you know, keep a sustainable level, recognize that politics are going to be messy, but recognize also that we still have a lot of influence to keep them from going off the edge. And we have to apply that carefully so that we're not responsible for everything in Afghanistan. But this is within the doable. And messy, complicated, corrupt, and gee, sometimes their parliament is at an impasse. We shouldn't be entirely surprised by that political habit. But I think it is still doable, is the conclusion of the paper.
So let me, Ron, follow up very briefly with you on another big question, but this one just to give a short answer to sort of set up Jim Cunningham. Do you see net progress in Afghan politics? You've been watching a long time. And I think a lot of American voters, in response to this metaphor you used about patience and impatience, would say, well, I can be patient as long as I see that things are headed in generally a positive direction. But if they seem to be stuck or falling backward, then maybe there's not as much of a case for patience. Do you see actual progress, whether it's in the way President Ghani and Dr. Abdullah work together in this 1-2 tandem or in other ways, the next generation that you mentioned earlier? Do you see a solid basis for being hopeful, given the trajectory that we're on?
Yes, there is a solid basis, but you also need to understand that it is constantly one step forward or two steps forward, a step back, sometimes two steps forward, one step forward and two back. You will have both simultaneously. So you need to look at the net. The net has progress. It also has a lot that we can do to enable more progress, including one of the ideas in the paper, not constantly being in a policy review. Because one of the things that has injected uncertainty into Afghanistan, aside from Taliban and all the other things going on, is the constant fear that we're about to leave. And we've accentuated that fear by having constant reviews. So there is reason for optimism, and no, it's not kind of blue sky optimism, everything's going to work out.
Thank you. By the way, I should mention the other ambassadors who co-authored the paper that we've been referring to include Robert Finn, who was the first U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan after 9/11, and then Zal Khalilzad, to whom we're all indebted partly for helping spur and catalyze this project that produced the paper, and then the great Ryan Crocker, who, of course, has done so much in so many places around the world and also served in Pakistan. So his perspective was important for that reason as well. A lot of people on this panel had expertise on Pakistan, too. But I just wanted to make sure you were aware of those three additional co-authors. And now to the great Jim Cunningham, who, again, has set records for endurance and navigated the election in 2014 in Afghanistan and the transition then to the Ghani Abdullah government. I'd just like your take on that same question. Do you see net progress? And also, what kind of levers do we have, or what kind of influence should we be trying to bring to bear in dealing with Afghan politics going forward?
Well, like Ron, yes, I would clearly say there is net progress both on the development side and on the political side. But the kind of put this in perspective and then take a look at political operations in other countries that are much more advanced than Afghanistan is. So what happened in Afghanistan is you had a very bitterly contested election campaign and elections and contestation of the results. And by the way, on the upside, I want to note that in those two rounds of elections, no matter what else happened, millions of Afghans went to the polls and voted. Men and women, whole families would go and vote under the threat of Taliban attack. So that is really one thing that I take as a source for optimism. There is an impulse in Afghanistan for political engagement and for public participation in politics and in elections. So the elections were contested. Through hours and hours and hours of painful discussion, we came to an agreement on forming a national unity government. And here I want to note that for 2 years prior to the elections, I and Afghans, the political elite and journalists and a whole range of people, had been discussing the need for unity in Afghanistan after the elections. Nobody foresaw how this was going to turn out, but everybody foresaw the dangers of an election that would split Afghanistan either regionally or ethnically. So there was a very strong impulse to find a way to come together after the elections. So you have two gentlemen, Dr. Ghani and Dr. Abdullah, each of whom genuinely thought he had won the election, and they were forced into what is in essence a coalition arrangement. Now, coalition politics are difficult any place in the world. Bringing political opponents together is difficult any place in the world, so it shouldn't come as any surprise that this was going to be a difficult enterprise for Afghans to manage and for the government to manage. So none of the political process has gone as rapidly or smoothly as friends of Afghanistan would wish or Afghans themselves would wish, but they have over time, step by step, come together and checked off the various things that they needed to do, both to deal with the international community and to deal with their internal requirements. Most recently, they have come up with a plan for the next couple of years on reform and governance and economic development, which is going to be presented at a meeting in Brussels in a couple of days, which will set out a plan, an updated plan for the government and in its aspirations to move forward. They did a similar thing last summer at the NATO Warsaw Summit, where the international community, the United States and our allies, pledged continuing support on the security side for the Afghan military. So after this meeting on Wednesday, there will be a corresponding commitment from the international community going forward to maintain development assistance at something like $3 billion over the next 4 years for Afghanistan. So the planks are again in place to demonstrate that there is going to be a long-term international engagement in Afghanistan for the reasons that Dave and Ron adduced in terms of protecting not just our interests, but the interests of our some 50 partners who are engaged there, who see this project the same way we do, which is another cause for optimism. It's pretty unprecedented to have that degree of international agreement on almost anything. So that gets to the other point about changing the calculations of Afghans and their neighbors in the region. Clarity about what the United States, above all, is going to do in the longer term in Afghanistan and about Afghanistan is absolutely essential for those of us who want a stable Afghanistan in the future. And then we spoke about the effect of uncertainty on the Afghans themselves, but not only does lack of clarity about the U.S. commitment dishearten our friends, it also encourages our adversaries. And my view has always been, source of some frustration during the 3.5 years that I was in Afghanistan, where we were reviewing every 6 months or every 8 months what our force posture was going to be. Ending that cycle is absolutely critical. If we want to have a prospect for not just continued stalemate, but if we want to break that stalemate, we have to have clarity that the United States and our 50 international partners and the UN and NATO and the European Union are all going to be there and remain committed to making this project work and to providing the Afghans the time and space that they need to right their ship and to make it steadier than it is today. I think they can do that. As Ron said, there aren't any guarantees, that they will be successful, because much of this now depends on the Afghans themselves. And we need to keep driving that message home to them. It's their responsibility, their country, their politics. They need to get their act together, and they are. They are slowly doing so, and I think they will continue to do so. They won't be able to do that if they are laboring under the continued apprehension that we're about to pull the plug and leave them to their own devices. We can't guarantee Afghan success, but I can pretty much guarantee what's going to happen if we don't stay.
Thank you. Could I ask one quick follow-up, too, with you, Ambassador Cunningham, which is about all the other things in Afghan politics that are sort of coming up or overdue, parliamentary elections. Some people have talked about having one of these traditional loya jirga where the constitution might be reconsidered or elements to it. Perhaps this position for Dr. Abdullah could be turned into a prime minister-like position of sorts has been one of the ideas floated. Some people have wondered whether the limit on two terms for a given president might be relaxed, and this conjures up images of Mr. Putin in Russia and some of our friends in Central Africa, and what people wondering whether Mr. Karzai really has settled into permanent retirement. You can comment on that or not as you wish. But on any of those topics, everything sort of seems to be behind schedule. Is that a fatal flaw, or is that just sort of the way it is? And as long as you point out, people keep sort of finding their way towards eventual consensus or some form of compromise, that's the best we can hope for and the best we need to hope for.
I don't think it's a fatal flaw. I think one has to be a little humble about imposing frameworks, or imposing is the wrong word, but viewing frameworks and intentions as deadlines that have to be met. That's the way kind of we're used to running our society. That doesn't always work so well, even for us. But more importantly, this is a completely new situation for the Afghans. They've never been through anything like this. The most important thing for them politically is to maintain a degree of political consensus and cohesion around certain central propositions. And it was probably unrealistic, I have to say, to think that they could, over a space of 2 years, that they could meet the goal of holding a constitutional loya jirga, which actually has certain constitutional requirements that need to be met, as opposed to what's called a traditional jirga. A traditional jirga cannot amend the constitution. The purpose of the constitutional loya jirga was not to amend the constitution. It was to decide whether to amend the constitution to create a position of a prime minister. Putting that off for a year doesn't seem to me to be a fatal flaw, as long as there remains a degree of consensus in the body politic that that's an acceptable path forward, and so far that is the case. The national unity government is always going to be, as Ron said, a difficult proposition. I remain convinced that there isn't any better alternative to that, and to making the political process work. They'll need a lot of help from friends as well as internally to do that. But they are now, after delay, like everything has entailed, they are now on finally a path that has a way forward to hold the parliamentary elections and then get to the constitutional loya jirga. And we need to encourage them to move down that path, but at their own, on their own doing.
Thank you. Let me mention the rest of the co-authors and then ask Jim Dobbins a question. He, as you know, was a special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, a construct that was established by President Obama. Richard Holbrooke was the first person to hold that position. We don't yet know if the next president will want to keep that structure, but of course that did give Jim particular focus not only on Afghanistan but Pakistan. Everyone on this panel lived that dual reality in their jobs, but Jim's job description and title underscored it. And his other former SRAP, as the position's often known, who was part of our co-author team, was Mark Grossman. And the other people who were part of our project were Vonda Felbab-Brown and Bruce Rydell from Brookings, as well as Claire Lockhart, who is the only person I think up here who wrote a book with President Ghani, and so another think tanker in Washington, David Sedney, who worked tirelessly at the Pentagon for many years on Afghanistan, and Ambassador Tony Wayne, who did so in Kabul as well. And so, Jim, if I could ask now to you, many people have said that as long as Pakistan has at best an ambivalent posture towards this situation in Afghanistan, seeming to want to keep the conflict going in some ways, even as it nominally cooperates with us in others, that there's really no hope. That as long as the Taliban have a sanctuary, as long as there's a state sponsor, or maybe that's a strong word, but I'll let you respond, as long as there is another country that seems ambivalent about whether Afghanistan secures peace, the insurgency will live on, and there's not really going to be a prospect of quelling this conflict. That's just a provocation. I want to put the more general subject of Pakistan on the floor for you to address as you wish. How should we think about Pakistan's role going forward?
Well, in the discussions which led to this paper, I think the Pakistan aspect was the most difficult. And in fact, it's the only part of the paper where the authors weren't able to come to a complete consensus and where it signals that there was some differences. On the Afghan parts of the paper, which is 80 or 90% of it, I think everybody manifested what you've heard up here, a degree of cautious optimism that if we stick with this in the long term, it's going to work out. On Pakistan, I think that there was a general feeling on the part of many who dealt with Pakistan that we failed, to move Pakistan in the most fundamental aspect of its policies toward Afghanistan. And a number of people do have substantial experience with Pakistan. In addition to Mark Grossman and myself, both of whom were special representatives for Afghanistan and Pakistan, General Petraeus, of course, had a lot to do with Pakistan when he was the Central Command commander, as well as when he was in Kabul as the ISAF commander. Ryan Crocker was the ambassador.
CIA director as well, working with the ISI, of course.
Yes. And Ryan Crocker was ambassador to Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. And indeed, I think all the ISAF commanders had relations with Pakistan of one sort or another. So there was a lot of experience and a general feeling that we had failed. Personally, I failed when I was special envoy for the region back in 2001 and 2002 to recognize that while Pakistan had abandoned its support for the Taliban government in Kabul, it hadn't abandoned its support for the Taliban. The Taliban were afforded a sanctuary to regroup, to rearm, to retrain, to refund, and to begin to project power and influence back into Afghanistan. I failed in 2013 and 14 to dissuade Pakistan from continuing to allow and even facilitate the activities of the Taliban in Pakistan in support of the insurgency in Afghanistan. But I'm not alone. We're not alone. I think Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, paid 18 visits to Pakistan during his tenure, and at the end he gave up and admitted that he too had failed in this respect. I think the paper does recommend more attention to this problem by the next administration, some combination of greater conditionality on security assistance, keyed specifically to cooperation in closing down Taliban sanctuaries in Pakistan, and also potentially greater positive incentives for Pakistan if it's willing to move in this direction. I do think that Pakistan's incentives have changed somewhat over the years. I think Pakistan originally saw the Taliban as a positive instrument for influence in Afghanistan as part of its geopolitical competition with India. I think now their motivation is not so much one of a positive gain as a fear. The Pakistan security establishment fears that they have enough enemies domestically, they don't need a new one, and they frankly don't want to number the Afghan Taliban among the many insurgent groups in Pakistan that threaten the Pakistani state. And so it's moved from an incentive based on geopolitical advantage to an incentive based on fear of the consequences of confronting the Taliban. Nevertheless, I think that we need to continue to try to affect this calculation in the government of Pakistan. There was a good deal of discussion about reconciliation, about negotiation with the Taliban. I think there was an agreement that this was an objective that should continue to be pursued, but it shouldn't be a prerequisite for American policy. We shouldn't count on it. We shouldn't allow our policy to revolve around the prospects of a negotiated settlement, that it was unlikely to occur quickly. It was unlikely to occur soon. It was unlikely to occur without a fundamental change in Pakistan, which so far hasn't occurred over the last 15 years. And it was unlikely to occur without some rebalancing on the battlefield to the advantage of the Afghan government. And therefore, we needed to concentrate on those things and hope that in the end that would produce the circumstances in which a negotiated peace might become possible.
Fantastic. I'm just going to work down the panel one more time before we go to you all for your questions. And before I do that, though, just a couple of additional points I'm going to very quickly tick off that are in the paper. And folks may want to comment on those further or on whatever else they are preparing to speak to. And also, I should note, Seth Jones was our final co-author. One of the things the paper says, in addition to the idea that there should not be these annual reviews, essentially a fairly long-term commitment of unspecified and not delineated duration, probably at least well into the 2020s, but others may wish to comment on that. In terms of the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, you probably are aware that President Obama has said we'll wind up at roughly 8,400 troops at the end of his presidency. So I don't know what the number is today, but it's probably about 9,000. There's some play in those numbers. There's some room for a little bit of variation as forces come in and out for temporary missions, but that's roughly the ballpark that he intends to hand off to either Mr. Trump or Secretary Clinton. And that will be just a modest reduction in the course of 2016, but of course it is a 90% reduction from the peak when General Petraeus commanded the Afghanistan surge. And so that's roughly where we are in troop numbers. Our paper suggests that without wanting to give a number, because it would require more tactical analysis of conditions next year than we could provide here in Washington in the summer of 2016, that nonetheless, we thought there was a case to enlarge the range of possible numbers and maybe even consider adding several thousand more temporarily. But as General Petraeus has underscored, the authorizations and authorities for what those troops can do may matter at least as much as the numbers. I'll just flag that for you very briefly. In terms of U.S. financial spending in Afghanistan, many of you are aware that we devote roughly $1 billion a year right now to economic and humanitarian aid and about $4 billion a year to the Afghan security forces. Those funds come largely out of these war supplementals, the Overseas Contingency Operation funds, and therefore they're budgeted a little differently. But technically, that's actually enough to make Afghanistan the number one recipient of American support in the world today, even more than Israel. So it's not often described that way because the Israel funding is long-term and it's in the regular budget. The Afghanistan funding is in the OCO account, but it's worth pointing that out. Again, a dramatic reduction from where things had been, but less dramatic than the reduction in U.S. troop totals. And then finally, we observed that there has been at least some progress in dealing with the corruption menace to Afghanistan, but a huge distance still to go, obviously, in that regard. President Ghani, I think, is making some serious efforts, and Dr. Abdullah. There have been some replacements of some leaders in the military and elsewhere who were corrupt or ineffectual. There's obviously a huge long distance to go. So I'll just highlight those bullet points for you and now ask my panelists to comment on whatever they'd like to in one more round before we go to you. General Petraeus.
Well, let me offer a couple of different comments. First of all is that it has always been the fact, even during the various Afghan policy reviews that I was privileged to be part of as the commander of Central Command and then subsequently COM-ISAF, it's always been true that what we were seeking to do was to help the Afghans develop the capability to secure themselves and to govern themselves to a good enough fashion. That's been the core of our effort, and it has always meant that you could not do this with just, say, counter-terrorist force operations. There were at various times desires to perhaps circumscribe what we were doing, describe it as a counterterrorism campaign, and so forth. But the fact is, it has always been more than that. It has always required more than that. I would add, in fact, one of the paradoxes of the fight against the Islamic State right now is that countering terrorism in the form of the Islamic State requires more than counterterrorism force operations. It requires a comprehensive approach. And this is what each of us participated in Afghanistan, and also what we did, frankly, in Iraq. It still requires a comprehensive approach. The key, however, in all of these, not just limiting this to Afghanistan, is to craft strategies that are sustainable. And that is because of a recognition, I think, that the efforts in which we're engaged are generational struggles. They're not just the fights of a few years or decades. I mean, back in the beginning of the effort in Afghanistan, I suspect that many would have contended that we would never be able to sustain a strategy for the 15 years that we have done it or so now, or nearly that. And the fact is that we have, in part because we have over time made it more sustainable in terms of the costs, in terms of loss of life, and then also in terms of the budgetary commitment. And that needs to continue to guide the effort that we're going to pursue there so that we can indeed pursue an enduring commitment that will not be threatened by concerns about that. One interesting comment on the peace initiatives, again, I think all of us have always had a realistic assessment that certainly give it your best shot. But if you can't threaten the enemy, you can't go after the leadership, if you can't really, we've had one major exception of that recently with Mullah Mansour, but if you cannot do that regularly, it's pretty tough to compel your adversaries to come to the negotiating table. And that has always been the sense. We did, however, see very recently the signing of an agreement between the Hezbi Islami, the former Hekmatyar group, and the Afghan government. That took some 5 years, in fact. I actually did the first meeting with the nephew of Hekmatyar and one other individual from that group in Kabul shortly before changing out as ISAF, and it's been very interesting to watch it ever since then. But that actually has been concluded. We'll now see what the results are in the field in that particular regard. I'd also note that with respect to Pakistan, we've had periods of very close cooperation. Again, this has been somewhat paradoxical as well, and I would hold out the year 2009, where both the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, and I had very close relationship with the Pakistani Chief of Army Staff, General Kiani. Indeed, we were helping Pakistan in a very significant way as it launched its counterinsurgency efforts against the Pakistani Taliban, the Tariqi Taliban Pakistani, and went into Swat and then Bijur, Momand, Khyber, Oreksai, South Waziristan, and started closing in on North Waziristan. And there was real hope at that point in time that perhaps it could really reduce the area of North Waziristan in which Al-Qaeda, Haqqani, other IMU, and others were located, so that perhaps other campaigns could take a toll of them. And then, very unfortunately, several developments really unhinged that level of cooperation. As I recall, it was WikiLeaks revelations. It was a book by Bob Woodward that had some uncharitable comments from various folks about some of the Pakistani leadership. And then a bit later, it was the Raymond Davis affair, the contractor for the CIA who shot and killed Pakistanis on the street when being threatened by them. And this sort of took the wheels off the bus of that cooperation. I just want to note that, though, because, again, this level of cooperation was very considerable. With our liaison elements all the way down at brigade levels in some cases, and various opportunities for actual assistance very much being realized, and very, very sad to see that end because of the prospects that that might have had, noting that, of course, they're fighting the Pakistani Taliban, not the Afghan Taliban, and not the Haqqani network, other than just perhaps reducing that space for operation. But I would not give up on that, noting really very much, though, the reality that Jim Dobbins laid out, that they have lots of enemies already. They know the existential threat is actually the extremists inside the country, even more so than countries outside the country, even in times of tension as we see right now. And that creating more enemies, and even more so if you do so down in Balochistan, which they're already worried about, and where it's publicly known the activities of the Pakistani army are greatly circumscribed, these are the realities that we deal with, and this is what makes it so complex and complicated. Thank you. Ron.
Thanks. It is complicated, which is always an invitation to talk too much, for me anyway. But let me make three points which I think are interrelated that are going to be important for the next administration. One is the need for steadiness in U.S. policy. Because a lot of what we have experienced has been exacerbated by either change or the constant sense of change in both high policy and sometimes just in operations on the ground, driven by that. And we are so big, so influential, that everyone takes our position into account in thinking about their own. Whether they're friends or enemies, figuring out what the U.S. is doing is a part of their policy analysis. It's a very important piece. And when they don't know, they guess, and often they worst case it. So steadiness is going to be important, and allied with that second point is clarity of explaining what the policy is. And explaining a policy is a little like a political campaign. You don't make your stump speech once and go home. You have to make it over and over again, and it has to be your actions have to be very clearly linked to your statements, because that's only through your actions that you get credibility for the statements. So that'll be a big piece. And the third point that I want to make, and then I'll quit, is we are going to have to maintain pressure on the Afghan government for various kinds of reform. And there's a lot of discussion about that. In so doing, we have to make it pressure for reasonable progress, reasonable goals over reasonable times. And when we stand up pressures for clean government very quickly, we're not going to get there. We need, for a lot of reasons, including some which are human nature, but we do need to prioritize. Not everything is equally important to us. The efficiency of their military is really important. The efficiency of their interior ministry, police, intelligence services, a couple of others. We can focus down on those and then have more reasonable time expectations. But that means we have to be willing to talk in terms that are more graduated and more nuanced. And our public discussion tends to be in terms of absolutes. And in terms of absolutes, we will then generally fail. So steadiness, clarity, and reasonable pace of change that we convey to the Afghans as well as the Americans, I think, are going to be important components of a policy.
Excellent. Thank you. Jim.
I think the final comment I'd like to make is that goes again to the notion of both fatigue and commitment. And that's that, from my perspective, one has to look at Afghanistan not in isolation as America's longest war, which is a phrase that's become quite commonplace now, with the implication that we can't continue that war. The war is not in Afghanistan. The war that we're engaged in is one with an ideology, the distorted ideology that drives Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the other groups aligned with that. That's the war. That's the conflict that we saw that began on 9/11 when I was ambassador to the UN. So that conflict is going to go on for a long time. It is generational. It's not a military conflict. We cannot win that conflict through military means. It needs to be won through a combination of military means, diplomatic means, ideological means, cultural means, religious means. All those things need to be woven together to stem and then finally defeat the ideology. Afghanistan is just one expression of that conflict. And that's a conflict that now extends from Asia all the way through into Africa. We need to find a way to make that clear to our own people and to publics around the world, and need to find a way to generate the kind of international cooperation, the multilateral, multifaceted strategy that General Petraeus mentioned a little while ago, to come to terms with, understand, and defeat the ideology. In the meantime, we have a time and place in Afghanistan where we have invested a considerable amount of time and money and blood in dealing with that particular conflict, and we have a way forward with a willing partner that can work, and I hope that will be understood by the next administration.
Great. Jim?
Well, Ron has stressed the importance of repetition of one's message, but I think we've probably repeated our message enough for one session, so I'll cede the floor.
Well, but I am going to ask you then, since you're so kind to do that, I'm going to ask you one question, which is, we've all talked about Pakistan already, but there are at least three other key external players that, to me, are near the top of the list of importance: Iran, Russia, and China. And I'm not going to ask you to talk about all three. I'm sure some will come up in discussion, but do you want to say a word about any one of those three?
And can I just up front say that, you know, one of the reasons that he was such an incredible diplomat was that, unlike many of his counterparts, I'm sure present company excluded, he actually did not hold the mic forever and was willing to surrender it. And I salute you yet again, Jim.
Thank you, Dave. You know, we maintained a dialogue with all of those countries, and particularly both in when I was doing the job in 2001 and 2002, I had a close relationship with Iran, a very productive relationship with respect to Afghanistan. It was a high point and also a missed opportunity that the Bush administration didn't pick up on. When I was back again in 2013-14, I initiated meetings with all of Afghanistan's principal neighbors, including the ones that you mentioned. And I think all of them helped in the crisis, the electoral crisis in 2014, in urging Ghani and Abdullah and their camps to come together and form the unity government. And I think if any of those countries had strongly intervened against that, we would have had a much more difficult time. I think that China has been very cautious. It's talked a good game, but it hasn't really put much on the table in Afghanistan. But it's on balance helpful rather than unhelpful. Iran has played around with the Taliban slightly, but not nearly as much as our ally Pakistan has, and it supported the regime in Kabul from 2001 and continues to do so. Russia has become kind of sour. Their view is we failed, you're going to fail too, but they haven't actually done anything to help us fail. And again, on balance, have been marginally helpful, although sour and particularly since Crimea, more distant and difficult.
One last footnote, though, you may want to comment on when you were at Central Command. I know you worked a lot on the Northern Distribution Network and the logistics through Russia, or its former republics of the Soviet Union were very important, as I recall.
I thought there were common interests that we had with Russia when it came to Afghanistan. There's plenty of places where we have conflicting interests, to be sure. In fact, I'd proposed a trip to Russia as the Central Command commander and then ended up going back to Afghanistan, wasn't able to do that. But those were threefold. One was that they shared an interest with us in not seeing extremism expand through Afghanistan, up through the Central Asian states, and, of course, back into Russia. They had enough problems that they had on their own. We felt that they had a very keen interest as well in fighting the flow of illegal narcotics. Addiction was a big issue for them already at that time. Again, same interest with the Central Asian states. And then finally, that generally, we think we all had an interest in the Central Asian states prospering and doing reasonably well economically also, especially considering that for each of them, their biggest trading partner in the place to which they sort of had a default position was Russia, given their status as Soviet republics under the Soviet Union.
Great.
And I think, for what it's worth, I think that was what enabled us to open the Northern Distribution Network. You'll recall the final element, we had to get President Karimov, who just passed away of Uzbekistan, to agree to do that. And I had meetings with him that ultimately resulted in getting that approval.
So let's go to the audience. We'll start with two questions at a time here in the second row, Harlan, and then the woman in the red, and then we'll go to the panel.
Oh, that's not Harlan. Harlan's right there.
Yeah. Okay. Her and then.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. My name is Nazira Azim Karimi. I'm correspondent for Aryana Television Network from Afghanistan. Thank you very much for all you guys' statements. It was wonderful. But the top hot topic in Afghanistan, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar participation with the Afghan government. Women in Afghanistan unhappy. They think that Hekmatyar is anti-women. What do you guys think? And people want to know, people in Afghanistan, that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's name will be removed from the blacklist. That's a big question mark. And also upcoming Brussels conference, what do you guys expectation from the donors? Thank you.
Go to Harlan, please.
I'm Harlan Ullman-Mike. Congratulations, is an exemplary group, and you've done a great service. I have a rather broader question, which may lead some people want to seek early retirement. If you take a look at the state of the world today, and in January 21st, you've got Brexit, the Colombian public has just rejected FARC, you've got a decline in world trade, you have an anti-globalization movement in both parties in this particular country. You take a look at everything from West Africa, Nigeria, through the litany of Libya, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Yemen, et cetera, et cetera. We have all these multi-crises, and then to throw in Mr. Putin and President Xi. And on top of that, one of my greatest concerns is I'm afraid that the U.S. military may be headed to a hollow force, because I don't think we're going to be able to spend enough to keep it at the current levels of readiness and modernization. So how then do you integrate in the U.S. government? An administration comes in for 6 to 12 months, it's not going to be fully manned and ready. How then do we enable it to take sensible decisions, because your recommendation for an enduring, sustainable presence is absolutely right. But giving all these competitive forces and factors, how do you make the case, not just for this, but combine it to the larger priorities that are going to be facing the next president, which are really quite daunting?
So why don't we start with Jim and then work this way and see what each person might want to say?
Well, despite the, you know, the premise of your question that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. There are. You remember the 1990s, that glorious period where the world's only superpower, and it all seemed so peaceful. There were more civil wars going on then. There were more people being killed. There were 40 different civil wars going on throughout the first half of the 1990s. You had Rwanda. You had massive genocide. You had war in Europe for the first time since World War II. So let's put the current situation in some perspective. The Middle East is in chaos. Well, other regions have been in chaos before. Now, to the specifics of your question, happily, President Obama has decided to leave to his successor the future of the American commitment in Afghanistan, and he's going to leave a reasonably robust force and a reasonably substantial economic assistance budget, which will carry the new administration through a number of months during which they decide what to do. We hope they'll take our advice. It's not something they need to decide on in the first 3 weeks unless something develops in Afghanistan that forces early decision. So I think that that Obama has put the next administration in a position in which it can take its time in deciding how deeply and how enduringly to commit itself in Afghanistan.
Thank you. Jim.
Well, it's a question about the agreement with Higg. The peace agreement contains as an integral part of it that that Hekmatyar's group will abide by the provisions of the Afghan constitution and the political engagement, how Hizb Islami will be politically engaged, shouldn't be that difficult because there is already a peaceful faction of Hizb Islami which has been in the government for quite some time. So I think that should prove relatively easy to work out.
Ron?
I just follow up on that. You know, Hekmatyar is a pretty nasty person with an exceptionally nasty record. And whenever you get a peace agreement, as you had with the FARC, and as you've had in certain African conflicts, you get this question of the tension between making peace and trying to have some kind of accountability for the past. The problem is, if you have accountability, you don't have peace. It's very difficult to persuade people that they should make a peace agreement so that they can go to jail. You know, it just isn't, it isn't a real attractive approach. And in the West, we have not had a really focused conversation about this. We have a lot of discussion of transitional justice and a lot of discussion about the importance of negotiation. And we have, in particular cases, come to certain conclusions. But it's been very, very difficult for people to accept that at least short-term justice isn't going to be possible if you want peace. But I think that is certainly the case in Afghanistan, because once you open this door, then you say, well, does this mean that if the Taliban negotiated for peace, they would have to be willing to go to prison themselves? What about all the people who are in the government who have human rights questions in government? I mean, civil wars are inherently nasty and messy, with all kinds of violations, and Afghanistan has been in civil war for years. And I think the fact of the matter is that there is no way you can both bring people together to go forward and go backward for account settlement. And that is just a fact that we're going to have to deal with. Now, you can engage them in certain ways that prohibit the behavior in the future. But the desire for vengeance and the desire for peace simply cannot coalesce and coexist.
Let me just take Harlan's question a little bit, which is characteristically provocative, having known Harlan for decades. First of all, to add to what Jim said about what the next president will inherit, I think the next president will also take over a policy, a fight against the Islamic State, in which ISIS in Iraq will either have been defeated or very clearly on the road to defeat. Indeed, as I've written elsewhere, the real challenge in Iraq going forward is not the Islamic State. It is politics. It's politics up in Mosul and Nainua province, where I spent a year after the fight to Baghdad as the commander of the 101st Airborne Division, where the most complex human terrain in all of Iraq resides. And it's politics in Baghdad, where in the last week alone, a faction that is challenging the prime minister, that appears to be led by the former prime minister, has had a vote of no confidence that removed the minister of defense, and then a vote of no confidence that removed a highly respected Kurdish political figure, Hoshyar Zebari, the minister of finance, previously the minister of foreign affairs. So politics is going to be the challenge there, but again, at least the fight against the Islamic State will have moved forward a good bit further, and Mosul likely will have been liberated at that point in time, that to take place presumably after they take care of Hawija. Could I then draw out, though, and just offer, I think, something that I've also written about, which is five lessons I think we should learn from the experience of the past 10 to 15 years in the Middle East, one of which is that America has to lead. And I think this is why it would be imperative to continue to move forward pretty quickly. First is that ungoverned spaces in the Middle East will be exploited by Islamic extremists. Same is true of North Africa and the Central Asian states. But that's a reality. The second is that Las Vegas rules don't apply in these regions. What happens there doesn't stay there. Rather, it spews out and affects not only the region, but even our allies and partners in Europe, most specifically, of course, in the case of Syria, which has pushed a tsunami of refugees into Europe, causing the biggest challenge in domestic political arenas in various of the states there, bigger than even the Euro crisis. Third is, in responding to this, America does have to leave. We have the assets, particularly if we can employ them as we are in Iraq now. And you can argue about how long it took us to get to the point that Islamic State is seen as a loser, and that really has mattered, because the sooner they're seen as a loser is the sooner that they are no longer effective recruiting on the internet and social media. But that is the case now. And the use of the assets of our intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets, precision strike, and industrial strength intelligence fusion is something that only the United States can bring to bear. In fact, Mike and I made in a piece in Foreign Affairs recently talking about America's awesome military and how to keep it that way. The fourth, though, and by the way, we always want to do it as a coalition, and that should especially include Islamic countries. This is an existential threat for them. It's more of a clash within that civilization than it is a clash between civilizations, to recall the words of the great Harvard professor Sam Huntington. The fourth is that the response has to be comprehensive. Again, the paradox is that you cannot counter terrorist forces with just counter-terrorist operations, at least not when the terrorists are an army, as the Islamic State is really in Iraq, noting that it's also terrorist cells and it will revert to more guerrilla techniques and tactics, presumably when it's defeated in Iraq and as it's under greater pressure in Syria as well. But again, this has to be a comprehensive campaign. The goal, though, should always be that we are enabling others to do that, as we have done actually in Afghanistan, as we are now doing in Iraq, having helped reconstitute their forces, so that they're the ones fighting on the front lines, and so that the costs to us, again, are kept as modest as they can be, because this has to be a sustainable campaign. Lesson number five is this is a struggle of a generation or more. And again, everything we do has to be done with that in mind. And again, that affects what we're doing in Afghanistan. It affects what we're doing wherever we are fighting the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda affiliates, you name it.
Can I just underline one point? Well, I'm totally agreeing with everything General Petraeus just said. The comprehensive approach needs to include much greater unity within ourselves in our political and our military instruments. And we have achieved that in the past at times when you have, as General Petraeus did with Ryan Crocker, or Ryan with Odierno or Jim Cunningham, but it's very personality dependent. We have no place, the only place in the U.S. government where the military and civilian lines of decision making come together is the President of the United States. And he or she in the future, see how it comes, cannot make all these decisions. And there's a really serious need for rethinking how we produce the greater unity of policy and action that we constantly talk about. We need the comprehensive approach with our allies. We could lose a little more comprehensive approach within ourselves.
Thank you. So let's have another round. We'll go to the middle part of the auditorium and then go to another round after that. So woman in black here, yes. And then after her will be Gary Mitchell, and then we'll go to the panel.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamana from Women for Afghan Women. My question is about the women's rights situation in Afghanistan. As we see lack of media coverage on Afghanistan, it always increases the fear among Afghans that Afghanistan will be abandoned by the United States, and also the level of aid will decrease and the security situation deteriorates. And women's rights is very related to the security situation and to the level of aid and everything. And also, once, my question is that
you've already been pretty clear. I mean, I think we can already respond as things are. Do you want to add a question, or do you want to leave it at that? That's fine.
Got it.
Yeah, and then let's go to Gary, and then we'll even take a third on this round.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to venture into dangerous territory, which is a metaphor. And that is, as we were thinking about the composition of this panel, there was one area of expertise that was not represented, and that was oncology. And though we are met today to talk about Afghanistan, I think Ambassador Cunningham suggested that that the enemy is an ideology, and that ideology, it seems to me, attacks in places of vulnerability, as General Petraeus says. Those areas of vulnerability happen to be, for the most part, countries with names, although the enemy per se does not have an address. So the question, it seems to me, if this is about the importance of an enduring commitment, the importance of a communication that makes clear to people why that commitment should be enduring, et cetera, it seems to me there are two things that that must be present, and I'm not sure whether we've touched on them. One is some form of metrics, something that says to people, we told you this was to be enduring, and there are certain guideposts, certain metrics that we will determine, much as an oncologist would determine with a cancer, and we'll tell you when they've been met. And second, so that if that is done, that heightens the level of domestic support that would be essential under any set of circumstances for America, for any president, for any Congress, to do what this group of experts has said we need to do.
Good. Let's take the third question here, and then we'll go to the panel.
Hi, I'm Jade Wu, and I was a rule of law advisor in Kabul and Kunduz, and Ambassador Dobbins, I failed too. But I have a question, slightly from a different angle. I'm focused on our Afghan staff, the Afghan staff that we, the international community, hires. We like to think that we hire the best of the best, the university trained, the multilingual. And we've all seen in recent years, a number of these people have taken the U.S. Special immigrant visa and have come here, bringing their intellectual and professional resources here. And we've also heard that a number of them are not gainfully employed, and I have personal knowledge that some of them are not employed. So,
you're talking about here or over there?
Here in the U.S., because their degrees don't translate well here. Mm-hmm. So my question to all of you is, do we, as America, have some sort of strategy, or do you know of some strategy where we are tapping into these people, their rich network of resources, their inside knowledge, their language, their ties to Afghanistan, to help us in our future relations with that country?
Thank you. And Jim, you want to start again, or did you want to start?
Can I go? Because I'm going to have to catch a plane
yes,
in a couple
okay.
of minutes.
Okay, so we'll let you speak. This will be the final word from General Dave.
Let me actually address what Gary said, but in a perhaps different way, if you will. There's lots of metrics. I think we could sort out which metrics might show the kind of progress or lack of progress that we are seeking to achieve. I don't think that's undoable at all. And again, we put a lot of effort into having real rigor in our metrics and so forth. What we do have to do as well, and you started to go toward this, I think, is encountering the ideology. We've got to do a lot better in that. We have tried a variety of different initiatives over the years at Central Command. We had a countering malign influence and extremist influence effort. You can have people that can be active in social media, on the internet, trying to provide alternative voices to those of extremism and doing it in the proper dialect and with Islamic training and so forth. And now you have the new State Department initiative, which I applaud. But again, if you look at the resources provided to it, it just can't have that significant an effect, knowing how much this kind of thing costs and knowing what we achieved when we had the really substantial resources during the various surges. But what is hopeful now, I think, is initiatives being pursued by the internet service providers and social media platforms. And that, I think, is actually very, very useful. To see what Jared Cohen is doing with what used to be known as Google Ideas, now it's Jigsaw, so that if you Google search for, say, ISIS or Islamic extremism or you name it, those kinds of search terms, what you get back is not just what you would have normally gotten in the past. You also get back stuff that counters that kind of activity and that kind of influence. It's basically alternative voices. If you ever look, for example, I'm told they said, look at, there's been a huge effort with this in other areas, including in suicide prevention. One of the efforts is that someone gets back not only, yep, that's the way you can do it, but man, you know, it doesn't always work, and man, it's really unpleasant if it doesn't, and you're worse off than you were before, this kind of stuff. That's what is hugely helpful. The fact that Twitter is taking down accounts now, that there are fairly sizable efforts out there to identify this kind of activity, and that is something I think that's hugely important. We will put a stake through the heart of most of al-Baghdadi's lieutenants, including most recently al-Adnani, a very significant operational coordinator and talented in that regard, will ultimately, I would assume, catch up with al-Baghdadi. You can't run a caliphate and a war and an army without at some point ending up on the X. But we may not put a stake through the heart of the ideologies that are, again, to which some people are prone to be influenced, and that's the effort that requires more and more effort, and I'm sure the next administration will have to pursue a lot of stuff in that regard. With that, let me just again say thanks. What a privilege it was to work with the great Dr. Mike and the diplomats, other generals, and development
thank
workers and
thank
so
you.
Forth.
Watch
thanks.
Your microphone.
Don't forget the mic.
Yeah. And we will, as you're leaving, we'll give you a round of applause, General. Ambassador Newman, over to you, please.
I'm running out of time. I recognize the need for metrics. I hate them. Most of them are bad, but we live in a world that likes metrics. You know, I sometimes am amused by the fact that if the weatherman says 50% chance of rain, everybody says, okay, that's fine. If the weatherman said might rain, might not, people would say, what kind of weatherman is that? And yet the two statements are the same. So we'll probably have to have metrics, but let's be very careful. We have a few that they're good and that they're long-term. Women are going to, the state of women in Afghanistan, that's going to continue to be an interest. The biggest struggle will be in Afghanistan among Afghans. There are limits to what outsiders can force, and there are limits to how you do it without poisoning the debate by allowing opponents of women's progress to characterize the progress as a foreign imposition. So a lot of work, a lot of pressure. My colleagues have been involved in that too. But it has to fall in behind Afghan women and not get ahead of them. But it is also, for quite honestly, I think it is also domestically one of our strongest bases of support within the Congress and elsewhere. And on the special immigrant visas, I have very mixed feelings. I think it's extremely important that we allow people who have taken huge risks with our troops to get the visas. I think we've gone way too far in the speed with which anyone working in the U.S. government, Afghans, are entitled to SIV, the special immigrant visas. I don't think that many people working in our embassy or our bases are more at risk than their colleagues working in Afghan government ministries. So I'd like to see us speed up the one and restrict the other, and we're not going to do either. The biggest problem with tapping the knowledge of these people is that the law, the way I understand it, doesn't allow us to hire them to go back to Afghanistan where we need their knowledge. We have much less need to tap into them here. There are occasional things, but it's very hard to organize. So what we really need is a fix so that if they do get out, they've got the green card, they've got the safety bolt ticket out, and then let's enable us to use their skills in Afghanistan where we need them. And that takes a legislative change.
Jim and Jim, if it's okay, I'm going to take one last round and give it to you two to respond, if that's all right.
Okay.
So let's, gentlemen here in the front row, and then let's see who else, just to have some geographic diversity in the room, the gentleman in the blue and blue.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the information you've given. My name is Haseeb Al-Khozai, and I work for the Voice of America. Things have improved without any reason. I was born, by the way, in Afghanistan. I came here in 2008 to go to school. Things have improved from what they were in 2001, but they are not proportionate to the level of contribution that the international community has had in Afghanistan. And there's almost a sense of dependency created in Afghanistan. I could even quote the former president saying, they are here forever, don't worry, they're not going to leave, meaning the West. And he went as far as saying that, you know, take as much money as you can so long as you don't take it to Dubai, so it's not a big deal. There is the sense that instead of teaching them how to catch a fish, that we are going to provide them a fish every day or all the time. So what to do on that regard, and
great.
How, you know, there is a disconnect in what the U.S. interests in the region are and what Afghans perceive them.
Thank you. Final question.
Hi, my name is Jawad. I'm from Herat, Afghanistan, and I'm a student at American University. I had two questions. One of my questions was kind of asked already by this gentleman, but I still ask that what should have been done differently in the last government, or what has been done differently with the new government, or will do differently in terms of taking the most advantage out of this foreign aid? I mean, we have made progress. Yep, we cannot ignore that, but we cannot even afford our military, our public school teachers who are paid once every like 6-7 months. So what should be done differently? And my second question kind of was related to the security forces. And I was going to ask from General David Petraeus, but I still ask it. The Afghan military has been able to take over the combat operations and have made improvements, and they have fought bravely so far. And at the same time, the number of casualties has risen dramatically. And oftentimes, these Afghan armies are left behind in the combat field with no support. Sometimes they're surrounded by Taliban. We have seen in many cases, we have had a lot of casualties where they ran out of ammo and they couldn't fight anymore, and there was no support for them. Why do you think this happens? And okay, to some extent, it could be because of the government officials who are corrupt, as we saw in case of Kunduz, for example. Thank you.
Ambassador Cunningham, then Ambassador Dobbins.
Well, the issue of dependency versus self-reliance is indeed at the core of the debate, the discussion that's been going on between the Afghan government and the international community for. It started shortly after I got to Afghanistan in 2011. Finding that balance is always difficult, but it is part of an ongoing transfer of responsibility from the donor community to the Afghan authorities. It's driven by two things: our desire and the desire of the Afghans themselves that they become more reliant upon themselves. And that's a key theme of this government, of the Ghani government. And it's also driven by the realization some years ago that the amount of development assistance that was being provided to Afghanistan was inevitably going to decline. Part of the process has been how to manage that decline so that it's not so rapid that it actually becomes destabilizing, while Afghans themselves can take more responsibility for their own resources. That latter part is happening, but it has never been the case that there's some magic answer for generating revenue for Afghanistan, and that's something that has to be realized. There's no mining regime that's going to suddenly make Afghanistan a country based on natural resources. That will come in time, one hopes, but it will take a while. But
that's very, finding that balance is a crucial part of the discussion that's going to take place in Brussels later this week. I don't know if it's a good metric to look, or metric's the wrong word. I don't know if it's a good optic to look at what's different from the last government and this government in terms of how to get the best result out of foreign assistance. But the fact is that President Ghani actually knows and understands economics and finance and development, which is a huge asset for Afghanistan now, if they can find a way to take that and make it operational. He cares about this. He's been focused on it for a long time. I've heard him speak about it long before he was running for president, about the need to make better use of the international resources that are available. And I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that he's quite focused on that and will do his best to make that happen. On the Afghan security forces, yes, casualties are too high, and there's still lots of problems in the field, and that's one of the key reasons why President Obama has decided to maintain the military forces that we have, most of which are devoted to what we call the train, advise, and assist mission. And it's that mission that is precisely helping to work the Afghan security forces, work out these problems of logistics and supply and tactics on the ground that they need to improve on to make their performance better. But at the same time, I want to reemphasize what somebody else, I think Iran, said. For all their problems, the Afghan security forces continue to fight. They continue to hold their ground. They continue to take a lot of casualties because they're fighting because I think they see that they are getting better. They are gaining greater capabilities. They are building their own air force, and that there have been setbacks. Unfortunately, I think we contributed to that by curtailing our own support during the time of the transition to combat operations, but that is now being rectified, and I very much hope that that will continue.
And Jim Dobbins for the last word.
Well, I don't think I really share the view that the progress in Afghanistan hasn't been commensurate with the resources that have been devoted to it. If you look at, again, metrics, between 2002 and 2012, Afghanistan grew as fast as China. Over that period, literacy in the country doubled. So twice as many Afghans can read and write today as could read and write in 2002. And if the 7 million children that are in school today stay in school, it'll quadruple. So four times as many Afghans will be able to read and write 5 or 6 years from now as they could in 2002. The UN Development Program has an index called the Human Development Index, which is a combination of health, education, and standard of living. Afghanistan grew at the fastest rate of any country in the world over that same decade on the Human Development Index. One measure of that is that longevity in the country is up 20 years. Afghans are living 20 years longer than they were in 2002, largely as a result of the reductions in infant mortality and maternal mortality. So in the middle of a civil war, they're living 20 years longer. This is the largest increase in human longevity that has ever been recorded since we started recording it. So I would say these metrics are commensurate with the resources that have been put into it. I would hope that they'd be more widely recognized.
I think we all know things are not all easy and well in Afghanistan.